Reeves Realty versus Carl Terry. And counsel, if I mispronounce the names, please let me know. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Solomon Rosengart, and I represent the appellant in this case. The issue here is really a very narrow one, because the only real issue is the $80,000 check. The defendant admits that at the closing of his loan, he received a check for $80,000. The question is, that's the only issue really in the case, what happened after he received the check? He claims he was told by the lender to give it to, first he said, quote, other people. Then he changed his testimony and said he was told to give it to Renee. Now, so there's no question he received the check. Now, I submit, first of all, that having received the check, he became obligated to pay it back. That's one thing. But he, putting that aside for a moment, his testimony really was not credible, because he couldn't explain why the lender told him to give it to Renee or other people. He really mumbled something, and he didn't really say anything that made any sense. So there's no reason why he would give it to Renee. But more than that, when shown the check, the signature, the endorsement in the back of the check, he said, "It's not my signature, because Carl is spelled with a C. I spell my name with a K." I'll point out, first of all, that the payee on that check was spelled with a C. So he then endorsed the check to conform with the name on the front of the check. But more important than that, prior to denying that he signed the check, he said earlier that he had endorsed the check to Renee. So he admitted endorsing the check and then denied endorsing the check. The other thing is, although he denied that it was his signature, there's no other signature on it. Renee's signature is not on it. Her endorsement is not there. If he gave the check to Renee or anyone else, and they deposited the check, then someone else's signature would be there. There was no other signature. So clearly, the check was not deposited or cashed by Renee or any other person. Clearly, it was him. So that alone shows that he received the check and he deposited the check. I also point out, he admitted they received the other check of $91,000 plus. Interestingly enough, and significantly enough, both checks, the $91,000 check and the $80,000 check, were deposited on the same day. Quite a coincidence to say that he deposited his check on one day, and Renee also deposited her check.
I understood, and help me understand if I'm wrong, but I understood that the district court did not award the $80,000 because of your client's failure to produce evidence that the $80,000, yes, the name on the check is Carl with a C versus with a K. The signature also contains the same error. Presumably, someone wouldn't write their name. If someone spelled my first name as Taria instead of Maria, I wouldn't sign Taria. I'd write my proper name. But I thought the district court's conclusion was based on its finding that there was a lack of evidence to trace where that money went, proof that that money was actually deposited into or cashed by Mr. Terry.
Well, it's undisputed. Mr. Terry admitted that he received the check. The question is, what happened to the check afterward? Well, the check that was produced in evidence showed Carl Terry, yes, but Carl is Carl. It's spelled differently, but the name is the same. It's not Terry or Mary, it's the same name. And the pay was spelled C, so he endorsed it as C to be consistent with the pay. It's not a different name. The name is still Carl, just a different spelling. But the point is, he admitted receiving the check. He said he gave it to Renee. Now, if he gave it to Renee, then presumably Renee would have deposited or cashed it. But there's no indication that Renee ever received that money or cashed it. And again, I want to emphasize, he didn't give any reason. He said the lender told him to give it to Renee. He was asked to explain why that was, and he didn't really give an explanation that made any sense whatsoever. So the threshold question is, why would he give it to Renee? He didn't explain it. So he, again, he admitted receiving the check. The question is, where did the check go to? There's a check that has a name on it, misspelled like correctly. But as I said, if the payee's name is spelled C, it would make sense that the endorsement conform to the payee's name.
But these are all arguments that go to the facts and inferences to be drawn by the facts. These are fact findings that were made by the district court. How can we disturb them, especially given the explanation provided by the district court?
Well, granted that this court generally defers to the trier of fact when it comes to issues of credibility. However, when a witness's testimony is implausible, then the court does not have to defer to the finder of fact. And we have another situation here where Mr. Tegra is clearly not credible. On his motion for summary judgment, he denied ever receiving any money. He denied signing any documents during the May closing. And in fact, and also in opposition to our motion for summary judgment, he said the same thing. And at the trial, in his opening statement, plaintiff's counsel again said, these are fraudulent documents, he never signed it, this never happened. It was only when Mr. Terry testified, he confronted with the documents, the note and the mortgage, which he agreed he signed, the estoppel certificate he admitted he signed, he then admitted it. So he didn't really have any credibility. When he started out on most of the summary judgment opposition, he said, I don't know anything about it. This never happened. In opening statements, counsel for plaintiff said it never happened. And then at trial, he admitted it did happen. So now we narrow the issue. So we had a witness here who doesn't have credibility. He swore twice, once in support of his motion for summary judgment, and again in opposition to our motion for summary judgment. He swore that this never happened, no document was signed, no money received. At a trial, he admitted that he did. So he did not have credibility to start with. So that alone should have raised questions in the court's mind as to credibility. But again, then the fact he admitted the $80,000 check, we do no evidence that Renee deposited a check, and there's no reason given why Renee would have received the check. He was asked at least a couple of times that he couldn't really explain why in the world he would give any check to Renee.
Well, someone named Renee did work for Teeves, correct?
No, there's no evidence of who Renee worked for.
Worked for Nachiman and Wright, I believe.
No, we don't know who Renee is. He never identified Renee's last name. He just said Renee. We have no idea who this Renee is.
I thought there was a Renee in the record here.
There was a Renee. He said he gave the check to Renee.
Aside from that, I mean.
I don't believe so.
I thought his testimony, meaning that the defendant's testimony, Mr. Terry's testimony, is that at trial was that he gave the check, the $80,000 check, to Renee at the direction and instruction of Mr. Reich.
That was his testimony, correct.
Okay.
But as I said, there's no evidence that Renee ever got the check or Renee ever deposited the check, or for that matter, that there was a Renee. So that's basically what I'm saying is that, yes, the issue of credibility generally is deferred to the district court, but here, when the testimony is implausible, and we have a witness who lied to the court under oath and summary judgment saying he never knew anything about this. And then he comes in and says, oh, yes, I did sign this. I did receive the check, but, you know, I gave it away. That I think, allows this court to not defer to the trier of fact in that sense. The other issue I want to raise is that the court reduced the interest by 50%. And I submit there is no legal basis for that. He said he reduced the interest rate, not the rate, interest. He reduced the interest by 50% because he didn't like the way Mr. Reich and his attorney, Mr. Schwartz, did business. The court didn't clarify what that meant, but that's not a ground for reducing the rent. He didn't mention, he said, that the way he did business apparently was an attempt to deceive Mr. Terry. There's no indication at all that Mr. Terry was deceived. Mr. Terry knew exactly what was going on. His testimony, again, came to the closing, expected $200,000. By the way, he got $180,000 because he was given a $20,000 check, but he never cashed, so it was $180,000. He admitted all this. So to say he was somehow deceived, I don't know what the district court was talking about. They say that they intended to deceive him. He was never deceived. He knew he had asked for this when he returned the first $100,000. He said he will ask for another $200,000. And he admitted that he got, as they said, at the end it was $180,000. So he admitted he got that. There's no deception. He wanted the money. He wanted to borrow the money. So therefore, there was no basis whatsoever for reducing the interest 50% or for any amount of that matter. So nothing else. We're certainly entitled to the full interest.
All right. Council, you are over by 3 minutes, but you still reserve your 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Damon Abushi on behalf of Mr. Terry. I think it's important, Your Honor, to start off with a very critical part of Judge Block's ruling. And it's this, and I'm quoting on page 7. It was designed by sophisticated businessmen in an unconventional money lending business to deceive an unsophisticated borrower, or at least create a dispute that has proven impossible to completely untangle. And that's the posture, that's the credibility determinations, that's the fact finding, which is not, as my colleague on the other side cites, as plain error. This court is not required to give it deference. This court clearly, the standard is clearly erroneous. And so from
that— So then you must agree, counsel, that likewise, when we assess the district court's credibility findings as to whether your client owed the $91,000, that we must assess that credibility with the same degree of deference.
Yes, Your Honor, but our position is not necessarily about whether or not the $91,000 was received, which if you want to talk about credibility, the record here is not very lengthy, but it's straight to the point as Judge Block runs this courtroom. My client was asked about it and he testified about it. The problem that we have here is the remedy that was fashioned. So the judge found, rightly so, that the 2009 loan was satisfied. That was undisputed. My client gave him a check. Through the machinations of the plaintiffs in this case, they didn't give him a satisfaction of mortgage. What they tried to do is some modification loan agreement, which the court correctly found was erroneous. And not only that, but they backdated it. The date that the document, the modification and extension agreement, is dated is 2 days after it was notarized. So the 2009 loan was satisfied. Now we get to the 2010 loan. Well, we have several issues with the 2010 loan. First, there was no proper assignment. There's nothing in the record that shows this loan was properly assigned. There are two lenders there. One lender signed it, ostensibly. And I say that because a lot of the questions that my colleague stood up here and was asking are only known to him and his clients, but they never testified. The original lender never testified. The original company never testified. Al Wright never testified.
I thought the court found that the assignments of the loan were proper on the first loan because it was as the business was winding down, or that the business was of the corporation, that a corporation that's closing has the right to, as it winds down its business, assign mortgages, and that on the also that the partnership, one partner found a partnership and one partner could assign a mortgage to Teeves Realty, and that's what the district court found the assignment to be proper on.
To briefly,
what's wrong with that finding?
So as to the first issue, a company that's one, you have two companies here that are not operating good standing, Needham and then Teeves Realty. Teeves Realty is a company out of New Jersey. We submitted evidence that it's not a functioning company, but you still need a person who signed this. They didn't bring anyone to come to the table and say, this was properly assigned. I assigned this mortgage. I assigned this note.
Is this an argument that the judge plainly erred in finding an assignment? I mean, we're not making this decision de novo. We have a decision by the district court.
Correct, Your Honor.
Judge Kahn just summarized. So is your argument that the district court plainly erred in finding that or what?
Yes, Your Honor. I respectfully submit that the district court, in terms of finding that the 2000. So there are several issues with the 2009 loan. One, the court correctly found that it was satisfied. And I think that ends the inquiry if Your Honors are satisfied with that for the 2009 loan. We don't have to go down the rabbit hole of a proper assignment since that loan was deemed satisfied. And in addition, the purported extension agreement.
Stick with what you think the district court error is here.
Okay.
What's the error you want us to rectify?
So the error, I respectfully submit, Your Honors, is that in fashioning the remedy in terms of, one, saying that this $91,000 is due and owing as a mortgage foreclosure lien, I respectfully submit that that remedy was an error for a few reasons. First and foremost, that 2010 loan, that's the genesis of the $91,000, that was not properly assigned, because if you look at New York partnership law, and I believe it's section 11, it says specifically that co-owners, does that mean you as a matter of law have a partnership? And so we have two individuals who ostensibly loaned money, one of them who allegedly assigned the loan, and we haven't heard
right,
from any of them.
A single partner, one partner could assign. Now, you're arguing that was error.
Yes, Your Honor, respectfully.
What precedent do you want us to look to identify that error?
Well, I think
what holding?
I think Your Honor needs to look no further than New York State Partnership Law, and it's Section 11 of the New York State Partnership Law, which says, and I'm paraphrasing here, and I can pull up the exact quote, but essentially that co-owners do not create a partnership just by the function of co-owning a property.
So you're saying there was never a partnership?
Yes. There was never a partnership. It was not established in the record.
Did you argue that to the district court?
Well, we did raise that issue that they needed both individuals to...
I know you argued that they needed both people to transfer, but to the extent you're now saying because they were never a partnership, I may have missed it. Did you argue to the district court that there was no partnership here?
We did argue it both in the summary judgment motion, Your Honor, and I do believe we raised it in the record at the trial at the trial proceeding.
I may have missed it.
I'm pretty sure it's there, Your Honor. So in terms of the remedy, so what His Honor did, and again, we don't necessarily dispute his findings of fact and his finding that there was this machination to deceive the plaintiff. But what he did is he essentially employed an unjust enrichment remedy here, which was not pled. And we raised that several times. So His Honor said, the plaintiff admitted to receiving $91,000, therefore I'm giving you a foreclosure on that number, but didn't necessarily tie it to the loan documents. And I don't think that he could, given the record below. So we respectfully submit that the court fashioned a remedy that was not available to the plaintiff on a claim that was not pled to the plaintiff. And then finally, in terms of the reduction of the interest, we respectfully submit that the court should have disallowed all the interest, because as the court found, repayment of this alleged loan, if Your Honors are so inclined to even deem that it was properly assigned, repayment of this loan was attempted several times by the defendant, and it was frustrated, quote, you know, and I'm quoting the court again, at least create a dispute that has proven impossible to completely untangle. So the lender at the closing told Mr. Terry to give the $80,000. Al Wright told it to give it to Renee. He did that. Mr. Terry's name is misspelled on the check. And my colleague says, well, it was misspelled on the front side, therefore it was misspelled on the back side. But Your Honors, I submit, who wrote the check? That's why it's misspelled on the front side. It was the lender who misspelled it, and therefore misspelled it again when they deposited it in their own account. And they have custody and control of their accounts. They have custody and control of canceled checks. It was requested in discovery. It was never produced. It wasn't even produced at the initial trial. And then His Honor granted them leave to open the record and submit those checks. And lo and behold, they're made out to a different name and cashed in an account that to this day we don't know who it belongs to. So, Your Honors, I respectfully submit...
With respect to prejudgment interest, could you just walk me through what the methodology here was in arriving at the prejudgment interest amount? I had trouble understanding
that. In terms of what His Honor did?
Correct.
So, from my reading of his opinion, is His Honor found that $91,000 was due and owing, and that there was a default penalty rate of 24%, and that equity mandated because of the defendant's conduct and business practices of frustrating the loan, frustrating repayment, that equity, which foreclosure is an equitable remedy, that through the court's equitable powers, he was going to reduce that 24% by half.
So did he do, is your understanding the district court did 12% or 24% over 7 years?
I believe the court did, and I want to get this right. The court will award prejudgment interest with a 50% reduction to $154,000. So what the court did is $91,864 times 0.24, 0.24 times 7. So he essentially reduced, instead of 14 years of interest, provided 7 years of interest. He took 7 years of interest in it. But again, we respectfully submit that at best, this is an unpled unjust enrichment claim, and the court should not have afforded the 24% interest in any circumstance based on the mortgage documents, again, because they weren't properly assigned, they didn't lay proper foundations, and it should not have been considered a mortgage by
and
the court.
We would have to find that by abuse of discretion, right?
Because that's correct, Your Honor.
The district court has discretion to set whatever interest rate it deems appropriate based on the circumstances of the case.
That's correct, Your Honor. There are no more further questions. I will sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
With respect to the argument regarding partnership, that was not raised. What was raised was the other person did not sign the assignment. That's all they said. There was no issue raised about partnership. So the first time it was raised is before this court.
And actually, that issue was resolved at summary judgment, right?
Before yes, the it trial. Was. Yes, there was a side in summary judgment as well. With respect to this argument, which I really don't understand, that really the court awarded unjust enrichment, Mr. Terry admitted that he signed a note and mortgage. It's simply, it's a mortgage entitled to be foreclosed. So I don't know where he gets the unjust enrichment. It's clearly a judgment of foreclosure based on a note and mortgage, which he admitted he signed. There's no question about that. With respect to the fact that Mr. Terry testified that he attempted repayment, he attempted payment, but not the amount that was due. He wanted the lender to give him a discount. The lender has every right to say no. That's not inequitable. What's inequitable here is that he made five interest payments and stopped paying over all these years. So the reduction of interest is based on equity, quote unquote. Well, equity says if a borrower doesn't pay interest for all these years that he didn't pay, it's only equitable that the lender get the full amount of the interest. And there's really no basis. Not a question of abuse of discretion. Yes, the court has some discretion, but the discretion has to be based on some law. And the law says, yeah, equity sometimes allows the court to reduce interest, but it has to be some basis. And the idea that the defendant was somehow deceived, there's no indication at all on the record he was deceived. He knew he went in for a loan for $200,000, it turned out to be $180,000. And yes, there's an issue about the $80,000, but there's no deception. He knew exactly what was going on there. So reducing the interest based on an alleged deception, which was never claimed and the record doesn't show, that does not make any sense. With respect to the assignment and the different dates, Mr. Schwartz, who knew gave the testimony. He was present at the closing. He knew everything. So he was the attorney for the lender. He was present, he had personal knowledge of everything, and he testified. There was a typographical error. There was no predating. The simple typographical error, and the court really should make nothing of this. And now, unless the court has any questions, the rest of my brief.
Thank you. Seeing none, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That does conclude. We'll take the matter, reserve decision on the matter. That